Good evening and welcome everyone. My name is Christina Biggs. I'm the local group leader for Bristol Christians in Science Group. This group's been going since 2009, but we're actually part of a bigger movement network, which is nationwide called Christians in Science. And you can join either the local group just by coming along. The donations basket's at the back, so if you can leave something averaging £4, then we'll be able to cover our costs. You can also join Christians in Science nationally by going on the website, £30 a year. You can get access then to our journal and also the national conferences and events across the UK. In fact, the Secretary of Christians in Science is here tonight, Diana Briggs, who's the wife of the speaker, Professor Andrew Briggs. So I'm delighted to have Diana here. It was actually at Diana who asked me to come here and found this group when she heard I was coming to Bristol and said, why don't you start a Christians in Science local group? So here I am. So there's a leaflet table at the back. So these are actually produced by Christians in Science UK, as it were. They're not particular lectures as such, but they're an illustration of the wide ranges of topics that we address as Christians in Science. So rather than just sticking to questions of evolution, we actually do look at a wide range of other things, bioethics, the environment, fine-tuning, the Big Bang. And next year we're hoping to do a series on the Earth and the particulars of what exactly we can do to save this fragile planet. So more on that later. So another leaflet that's at the back is Professor Ursula King is with us tonight, and she's launching her book next Thursday. So there's some leaflets on the table. And Andrew Briggs' books are here for sale. I'm sure you can get a signature for £20, a knockdown from £25. Andrew Briggs is Professor of Nanomaterials in Oxford, and actually is the first time there has been a professor of nanomaterials created especially for Andrew. And it's nanomaterials is all about the carbon nanotubes. And there's some really interesting effects come out that Andrew's been really digging into. So there's quantum computing, all sorts of chemical catalysis effects, and just a list, endless list of publications. So just using scanning tunneling microscopy, looking at carbon nanotubes, the little test tubes, very, very small test tubes, entangling quantum states. You can actually look at quantum mechanics with nanotubes. So it's fascinating work and very much cutting edge. So do grab him afterwards if you want to find out more about that. So I think that's it. So the talk tonight is the penultimate curiosity, how science swims in the slipstream of ultimate questions. And the main thing about this is that it's actually a partnership between the arts and the sciences. So we're going to be, Roger Wagner, I've had the privilege of meeting. He's a leading artist, and so we're very excited about looking at using image to discover how mankind's looked. But Andrew will tell you himself. So I'll just start with a prayer, and then we'll start. Dear Lord, we thank you so much for the beauty of your creation, and we thank you also you've made us to be curious about it. And this is the gift you've given us, especially in art, to express what we think of you, and what is man that you're mindful of him. And we just thank you for being interested in us and wanting us to be interested in you. Amen.
Well, thank you very much, Tina. What Tina did not tell you about herself is that her husband once occupied the flat at the top of our house. He was actually the second confirmed bachelor to occupy the flat at the top of our house. The first confirmed bachelor to occupy the flat at the top of our house was my co-author, Roger Wagner. And having been there for many, many years, One Saturday, we heard him vacuum the flat. And that was a sure sign, and not long afterwards, he was engaged to Annie, and then he married her. And actually, only a few days after they vacated the flat, Brendan came and lived there as a confirmed bachelor for many years, until one day we heard him vacuum the flat. The experiments that I do in my lab are looking at quantum phenomena in very small objects. One of the questions that we ask is, how does electricity flow through one molecule? And what we do is, to study that, we make a gap in graphene, which is a single layer of carbon atoms arranged rather like chicken wire on a miniature scale. And the gap we make is about 2 nanometers wide, so that's a meter, and you shrink it by a factor of 1,000, and that's a millimeter, and you can see a millimeter with your naked eye. And then you shrink that by 1,000, and you get a micrometer, and you can just about see a micrometer with a sort of school microscope, you know, with lenses that you look down. Then you shrink that by a factor of 1,000, and then it's far too small to see with a school microscope, but you can see it with the kind of electron microscopes that we have at Oxford, and indeed that they have here at the University of Bristol. And so we make a gap that's about 2 nanometers wide. It's a few atoms wide. It's just the right size for a molecule. We choose a molecule that's going to exhibit significant quantum properties, maybe quantum interference, maybe a Fano resonance. And we attach 2 wires to it. The wires are just short molecules, really. And then to the end of the wires, we attach something like a post-it note, one at each end. And these post-it notes come down and they stick to the 2 bits of graphene either side of the gap, and then we can pass a current through it. And then we have another nearby electrode, we call it a gate, and by changing the gate voltage, we can change these quantum interference effects, and we can measure the current through one molecule and study it. And at the moment, the experiments are controlled by humans, and you don't have to be down in the laboratory, because once you've set the experiment up, we have to cool it down, because we want to get rid of thermal vibrations, so we operate at 15,000ths of a degree above absolute zero. And then you control it from a laptop computer, which could be in the lab, but it could be at your desk, or it could be at home after dinner to save you having to go back in. On my way here, I just came from the Bahamas and arrived this morning, and I had a meeting at one of Bristol's most exciting startup companies. It's called Graphcore. It's a spin-out from another exciting company called Exmos. It's about a mile from here. And what they're doing is they're developing the most advanced computer chips in the world for machine learning. And machine learning is already changing the way that we do everything. This morning, I came back through Terminal 5 at Heathrow with a colleague, and there was a short queue with a human immigration officer, and there was a rather longer queue with machines that have learned how to compare faces with the data on your passport. And Bonnie said, "Shorter. I'll leave the machines to learn for themselves. I'll go through the human queue." I took my passport, I put it in the machine. Those machines have learned how to recognize human faces, which is a difficult task because it's different angles and different lighting and different expressions. And they've trained on 50 million faces. A human immigration officer who compared one face with a passport every minute for 40 hours a week for the whole of their working life would have seen about 4 million faces. So the machines are better and more reliable than the experienced immigration officer. Anyway, I went straight through, went round to the other side of the human immigration officer and gave Bonnie a grin while she was still waiting for her passport to be examined by hand. We're going to be implementing machine learning in my laboratory starting on the 1st of May. And already you probably know that machines are universally used for controlling computers are used for controlling apparatus in the laboratory and for logging the data. Before too long, machines will be in the laboratory deciding what to measure next. And the goal that we've set ourselves in our lab is that within 5 years from now, the machine will be deciding what experiment to do next to the standard of a second-year graduate student. So you can see in 5 years whether we achieve that goal. Now, what I want to talk to you about today is about curiosity. And curiosity is what drives science, but it drives much, much more than science. And curiosity extends to every sphere of questions worth asking. Why are we here? What is the purpose of life? How can God be known? How can we love better? And what you find is that wherever you have a culture or a community, or sometimes it's an individual, with a curiosity about these bigger questions, time and again that has proved conducive to the sort of curiosity about the material world that we call science. I wrote this book with a very distinguished artist called Roger Wagner. He was described 3 years ago in The Spectator by Charles Moore as Britain's best living religious painter. And I'll let him introduce how we started working together on this topic.
I'm standing at the junction of two roads in the centre of Oxford. Down there are the spires and towers of the historic buildings at the heart of the university. To my right and behind me, the streets are lined with new laboratories. Laboratories are being built in universities all over the world. But it's easy to forget what a recent phenomenon this is. In 1860, a cousin of my grandfather, who was an undergraduate at the time, took a photograph from just about this spot. Here it is. It shows a new building that had just been put up. There's still scaffolding around the door. Now, in the 18th century, there had been an observatory built just down the road. But since then, this was pretty much the first purpose-built scientific construction that the university had ever commissioned. And if we walk a few yards down the road, we'll see that it's still there. When I was an undergraduate myself, about to leave the academic world and go off to art school, I became fascinated by this building. I was intrigued by the way it brought so many things together. As an artist, I've sometimes put new work in very old buildings. But I've also been interested in the collision between ancient stories and contemporary realities. This building, the Oxford University Museum, was full of such collisions. It was built in the style of a Rhenish medieval town hall, but constructed like a Victorian railway station, in the latest materials of steel and glass. It was a building dedicated to the accuracies of science, but gave artists and craftsmen a free hand to indulge their fantasy and imagination. This museum had interested me for all kinds of artistic reasons. But when I came back to Oxford after art school and started work, I began to get interested in the scientific history of this place. And what had prompted that interest was getting to know a scientist. Today, Andrew Briggs is the first professor of nanomaterials at Oxford University. He investigates the strange world of quantum effects that lie at the root of matter. When I first met him, He'd recently returned to science after taking a theology degree. For many years, my studio was on the top floor of the house in North Oxford, where the Briggs family lived. And during those years, we began a conversation about science that later turned into a book. For Andrew, as for me, a starting point had been an interest in a particular building.
When I was wondering where to do my PhD, I went for an interview at the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge. Here's the entrance of it. It was an exciting moment. And as I walked through the doors, I looked up at this inscription that's carved in Latin on the doors. On the 1st of November, 1879, the Reverend William Gilmar, the rector of the Cambridge Church of St. Mary the Less, called in a house in Scope Terrace, not far from the Cavendish Laboratory. He'd come to bring communion to a bedridden parishioner who, at the age of 48, was dying from advanced abdominal cancer. He was told that the patient had had a bad night. In fact, he died a few days later, and he didn't expect there to be much conversation. But as he robed himself, he was a rather high church Anglican priest, he was astonished to hear from the bed a Scottish voice with a trace of a Galloway accent reciting from memory all five verses of George Herbert's poem about the robing of Aaron: holiness on the head, light and perfection on the breast. It goes on, my doctrine tuned by Christ, who is not dead, but lives in me while I do rest. Come, people, Aaron's dressed. What the priest didn't know and didn't discover was that the man on the bed had changed the world. 15 years earlier, in what the Nobel laureate Richard Feynman described as the most significant event of the whole of the 19th century, he'd written down four equations which not only describe a characteristic of the universe, but provide the basis for every electronic technology in the world today. But what the priest did discover was that his parishioner seemed to know the whole Bible by heart, and that the inscription of a verse from Psalm 111 on the doors of the Cavendish Laboratory had been inspired by a deep faith. And we'll come back to that story. I want to give you a little metaphor for this way that science swims in the slipstream of ultimate questions, or slightly to change the metaphor, how science flies in the vortex of ultimate questions. And the metaphor is of birds flying in a V formation. The bird at the front has to fly as hard as if it were on its own. But the next bird doesn't have to fly so work so hard, because it can benefit from the slipstream created by the bird in front. And in fact, these birds find the place where there's the greatest upcurrent, and they even adjust the phase of the flapping of their wings to maximize the benefit from the upcurrent of the vortex in front. And it's been fabulous working with Roger, because one sees through the painter's eyes ways and reality and truth in a way that's complementary to the way that one sees it with the background of a scientist. Here's one of his paintings. It's from a series of paintings called Out of the Whirlwind. This one's entitled Where Were You When I Laid the Foundations of the Earth? Like many of Roger's paintings, you get the big impact from the, in this case, the whirlwind. And then you look hard and you look hard and you see that the most significant pair of people in the painting is rather small by comparison. It's God asking Job a question. And the book of Job is a Hebrew writer from 3,000 years ago, showing how in the context of the really big questions, questions like, why do bad things happen to good people? And how can it be that someone who's known God intimately as his closest friend could subsequently find God remote and inaccessible? In the context of those really big questions, well over 100, nearly 200, depending on how you count them, detailed questions about the material world, questions about animals and geography and geology and cosmology. And here is Roger's painting of Job's response after all those detailed questions from God. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. After we'd finished the book, Roger and I decided to make a film about the penultimate curiosity. I'm a pilot, so we jumped into this plane here. It's called Golf Bravo, Golf Papa Lima. And we set off on a journey around the Mediterranean, visiting places illustrated on that itinerary there, where we felt that there had been really significant advances in curiosity. People had become curious in whole new ways. And I'll show you a little movie clip which starts with me and Roger sitting in the plane talking about where we're going to go to and why we're going to go there. And you'll see rather early on, Roger talks about the probably the oldest artifact we describe in the book. It's this abalone shell, and it has evidence that someone about 96,000 years ago was using it to mix pigment. Here we are at Oxford Airport, about to set off.
In the book that Andrew and I wrote together, we traced these motivations as far back through history as we could go. And now we're going on a journey to explore some of the key places in the long and extraordinary story that we discovered. I can remember that in the 1990s, what people called the human revolution only happened when Homo sapiens migrated from Africa to Europe and started making paintings.
And what changed that was the discovery in the Blombos Caves in South Africa of evidence that people were making symbolic markings 100,000 years ago.
I mean, in the newspapers they described it as the first artist's studio, which I love, because they found these extraordinary abalone shells which were used for storing and actually mixing pigment.
Only last year in Indonesia they discovered evidence that when humans started to migrate from South Africa, one of the things they took with them was painting.
And the first, what are pretty well the first European paintings were discovered just about the time we started writing this book.
Or at least thinking about it, yes.
Yeah, and that's where we're going now.
A la France!
Golf Papa Lima, I'm completing my run-up.
This journey will take us across the world and across time. It will begin in France with that discovery of a vast complex of prehistoric paintings. Paintings the leader of the excavations is convinced were religiously motivated.
We know they have a religious motivation, first because people didn't live inside those caves.
But paintings which also show an astonishing attention to anatomical accuracy.
Doing it with such accuracy might have been vital because they were recreating them.
It was made perhaps 35,000 years ago, and it's an astonishing piece of work. The journey will take us on to a city on the coast of eastern Turkey.
The ruins are somewhere inland, so I'm not sure we'll see them.
In 600 BC, Miletus was a coastal town, a wonderful centre for new thinking.
A city where, in the 6th century BC, a new idea of the divine coincided with a new kind of interest in the natural world. From there, we'll follow the route by which one man brought this idea to 5th century Athens.
Plato said he was the first person to work out how the shadowing of the moon was related to the sun.
Yeah, and he also said that the sun was not a god, but a fiery ball.
Which in 4th century Athens must have been a pretty controversial thing to say.
Yeah, I think he was probably quite a courageous chap, actually.
and visit the places where it provoked opposition and sparked a whole new way of thinking about the gods and studying the world. We will follow the path of these ideas to Alexandria in Egypt. But what happened in this great multicultural city when the philosophical religion of the Greeks and the revealed religion of the Jews and Christians came into contact? Well, the answer was riots. But we will also see how in a newly discovered philosophical school, where Christians and pagans studied together, a Christian philosopher who insisted that nothing should get in the way of truth anticipated one of Galileo's most famous observational experiments by almost exactly 1,000 years.
Two unequal weights dropped from a given height strike the ground at almost the same time.
Following this trail forward to the city of Pisa in the 16th century, we will discover how Galileo not only repeated that observation, but followed in that early Christian philosopher's footsteps in his conviction that pursuing truth as a Christian duty would reveal deep laws that govern the whole creation. Coming back to Oxford, we'll see how in the 17th century, religiously motivated natural philosophers sparked what we now call the scientific revolution. And finally, travelling first to Scotland and then to Cambridge, we will see how a 19th century scientist wrote down 4 equations which showed that the whole universe was filled with the surge of electromagnetic waves.
Their description of the fundamental gearing between space and time led directly to Einstein's theories, but they also provide the basis for all the electronic technologies that shape the modern world. The world we live in today begins with these equations.
And we will see how for that 19th century scientist, the discovery of those 4 equations, which revealed the deep unity of fundamental aspects of the universe, was carried along. Human beings seem to reach out beyond the horizon of the visible world in order to try and make sense of it as a whole. You could describe it as ultimate curiosity. If then our curiosity about the world around us moves, as it were, in the slipstream of that ultimate curiosity, you could describe it as penultimate curiosity.
That's why the book is called The Penultimate Curiosity. And these paintings in the Chauvet Cave in the Ardèche Gorge in the south of France really are quite extraordinary. They're of amazing quality. And as Jean-Claude was saying, we know that they didn't live in the caves. We know that the paintings were not a lunch menu. They weren't trying to decorate their living room. And it really does seem that their motivation was religious and that it led to a curiosity about the anatomical details of these horses that was essentially if you were going to paint them as accurately as they did. From those paintings, about 36, 38,000 years old, where we get these hints of curiosity about the anatomical world being in the slipstream of curiosity about religious motivations. Of course, it was before writing was invented, and we can't go back and ask them. But a breakthrough in writing occurred here in Miletus, which you're seeing from the air, which in the 6th century BC was a coastal town that was a Greek colony that was a wonderful meeting point of the curiosity of the East and the curiosity of the West. And a real breakthrough that occurred there was the concept of a divine first cause, what the Greeks called arche. And the transformation in curiosity that that brought about was that instead of thinking of earthquakes as Poseidon shaking the ground or the sun as Helios riding his chariot, or a storm at sea as Neptune getting angry. The concept of a divine first cause set people free to have a new kind of curiosity about the material and the mechanical and the natural world. They disagreed about what the nature of the arche was. It was actually a rather vigorous and rather fruitful debate, and some answers were better than others. But it gave them this new liberty for a curiosity about the material world in the context of these big questions about what lies beyond the visible world. Miletus could have gone on to become the intellectual powerhouse of the classical world, but that was not to be because of some bad decisions taken by the political leaders. And in that case, these bad decisions led to the Persian government coming down splat on the locals who wanted to exit, and the resulting diaspora meant that refugees fled to Greece. Actually, it was a bit like German refugees arriving in Britain in 1939. They'd no sooner got here that they discovered that this country was itself under attack, and that happened in Athens, but that settled down, and so you got a rather strong questioning of realities beyond the material world and realities within the material world, which was brought to light in a satire called The Clouds here at this theater. It was the theater of Dionysus. And the central character of this satire was, you know, interested in measuring how far fleas can jump and tracking the orbit of the moon and so on. He was easily recognizable as the local questioner, Socrates. At the end of the first performance, after all the roaring of the crowds, Socrates is said to have got up and given a slight bow to everybody because he recognized himself as the central character of the play. And it was all good fun at the time, which was 423 BC. Within 20 years, the humor had turned to something much more tragic, and Socrates was made to commit compulsory suicide by drinking poison for having, they said, corrupted the beliefs in the gods of the cities. And here he was challenging those religious beliefs, and in the context, in the slipstream of that sort of questioning, also asking questions about the natural world. Actually, it seems they got in a bit of a muddle because they were accusing him of saying that the sun was not a god but a fiery ball, and they were mixing him up with Anaxagoras, whose books were on sale at the time, apparently, but that didn't help Socrates, and he died. One of his pupils was Plato, who taught at the academy, from which we get the word academic in English. And one of Plato's pupils was Aristotle, tutor of Alexander the Great. And these people were all thinking, you know, about the big questions, the ultimate questions, and in the context of those, the questions flourished about the natural world. Fast forward 1,200 years to from 600 BC to 600 AD. This is a school of philosophy that was only discovered 10 years ago. It probably dates back to the 4th century AD. There are 20 lecture theaters, each of them, you know, seating about the number of people on one side of this church. It's an extraordinary discovery. This is one of them. In the 6th century AD, two students went there. One was a pagan student called Simplicius, and the other one was a Christian student called Philoponus, John Philoponus, lover of work. Simplicius didn't get tenure, and so he went further east and found a job in a provincial university in Baghdad, the House of Wisdom there. Of course, the word university hadn't been coined then. And he disagreed strongly with Philoponus, who did stay on at Alexandria and had a career teaching and writing there. And Philoponus, as a Christian, in the context of his Christian faith in God, started to question a lot of things that Aristotle had asserted. Brave thing to do, a bit like me sort of saying I think Einstein was wrong about almost everything. He challenged the idea, well, he gave a new concept to what we now call momentum. He called it impetus, or energia in Greek. And he said, look, couldn't it be the case that the same impetus, that the impetus that causes the planets to move in the sky, could that be the same as the impetus when an arrow flies? And that was very remarkable, because the accepted notion was that the heavens were divine and couldn't be studied in the same way as things here on Earth. And he was challenging that. He challenged it on empirical grounds. He said, look, the reasons you give for saying the heavens are different, that they give out light and that they glitter, you can find things on Earth that have those properties. Glass glitters, you know, shines. Fireflies give out light, and we accept that those are part of this material, natural world. He challenged Aristotle on laws of motion. Aristotle said that an arrow flying would come to its natural state of rest, and it would need something to keep it moving. And Aristotle's solution to that problem was that the air that was getting pushed out from in front of the arrow was coming round the back and propelling the arrow. Now, Philoponus had already challenged Aristotle's idea that there can't be a vacuum, because he'd watched the winemakers sucking up wine through straws. And he'd already worked out that you could have a vacuum there, and that in some way that he didn't fully understand, it could exert a force. But so he'd already got rid of this notion that you can't have a vacuum behind the arrow. But he also challenged, I think he had a great sense of humor, because his answer to Aristotle's notion of how an arrow keeps flying, he said, well, that's stupid, because if that was true, soldiers wouldn't need to throw their javelin at an enemy. All you'd have to do is to line them up on a parapet and get 1,000 men with bellows doing that, and the javelins would get propelled, and that doesn't happen. He not only got opposition from pagans like Simplicius, but he got oppositions from within the church. And the people in the church criticized him for not taking the Bible literally enough. And his answer to that was, the Bibles teach us the fact of God's creation, but not how it came about. One of the people who attacked him in actually rather unpleasant ways was a monk called Indigoplestes. Indigoplestes criticized John Philoponus for failing to say that angels move the planets. And Philoponus' answer was, again with a twinkle in his eye, he wrote, the Bible says nothing about angels moving the planets. Do they pull or push? His works were recovered in the Middle Ages through Arabic translations. There's a Latin translation, an early Latin edition. His works were known to Galileo. Galileo described Philoponus as a man driven by the power of truth to reject the falsity of Aristotle's views. But before Galileo came along, back in Oxford, here's Oxford one Sunday morning, taken by Diana actually, was the man who probably was the first chancellor of the university, Robert Grosseteste. There he is. Like John Philoponus, he deserves to be much, much better known than he is. He too was willing to challenge Aristotle, and he wrote that we should not needlessly try to make a Catholic out of Aristotle, but we should learn from his method of arriving at the truth. So feel free to disagree with his conclusions, but learn from his methodology. And there's a picture of Gross Test in a manuscript at Oxford, and there on the right is one of his writings about light. And you see how he's really beginning to think about refraction, he's beginning to think about the colors of a rainbow. His ideas on light were taken up by his star pupil, Roger Bacon, who worked out, you know, that there's a maximum angle of inclination that you ever see a rainbow at. And then moving on in the UK with a sort of Oxford connection was the work of Francis Bacon. Here are the frontispieces of three of Bacon's books, which to a large extent laid out a manifesto for science. The title page of the first one, The Advancement of Learning, depicts a ship on the sea with a quotation from the book of Daniel. Many shall go to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. The next one's the Silver Silvanum, which was published after his death. And there you've got the globe of the intellectual world resting between the pillars of Hercules, which for classical writers represented the edge of the known world, the ne plus ultra, beyond which there is no more. And then the third one, the Novum Organum, brings those two together in a picture of a ship plunging through the pillars of Hercules, voyaging to discover worlds unknown to classical antiquity. And in that sort of way, Bacon believed that, of course, Columbus had just discovered America. Bacon believed that by the distant voyages and travels which have become frequent in our time, many things have been laid open and discovered which may let in new light upon philosophy. And Francis Bacon highlighted the two leading motives for what came to be known as scientific research. The two leading motives were the glory of God and the relief of man's estate. Now, what was going on at this time? Well, on the continent, Luther and others had been revolutionizing the reading of the Bible, the book of God's words. And in particular, the Reformation stripped away layers of allegorization in reading the Bible. There were four well-defined layers of allegorization. They stripped those away and said, open your eyes. You can read the Bible for yourself and make sense of it. You don't need a professional to tell you what it means. And what Bacon and others were doing was saying, just as the reading of God's words is being revolutionized, so let's revolutionize the reading of God's works, the book of nature. And you can see it a bit in these frontispieces. I think it's probably too small for you to see, and anyway, I haven't got a laser pointer. But in that first picture, the pyramids actually are labeled Oxford and Cambridge. And the globe at the top on the left is labeled the visible world. And the globe on the top at the right is labeled the intellectual world. And they're shaking hands with each other. And if you like, he's, you know, got their way ahead of Roger and me in the way that the curiosity of science shakes hands, is entangled with this curiosity about the bigger questions. One of the first people to be influenced by that was John Wilkins. John Wilkins' fortunes waxed and waned in the Civil War and the aftermath, but a very important part of his life, he was warden of Wadham College. Here's his book, published 12 years after Galileo got into such trouble for his tiff with the Pope. And here is John Wilkins publishing a book with, on the left-hand side, Copernicus as one of the heroes on the front piece, and on the right-hand side, Galileo as one of the heroes. And it's rather lovely, Kepler, who provided the data for all these ideas, peering over Galileo's shoulder. And look at the structure up at the top. The sun nicely at the center, the planets going round it, and the stars. And what's very remarkable is the stars are in three dimensions. They're not just a starry, you know, sphere above us, but it's a three-dimensional space. Here's John Wilkins. That's his portrait in the hall of Wadham College. There are four presidents of the Royal Society portrayed in Wadham College dining hall. Three of them are in their bishop's robes because they were bishops as well as presidents of the Royal Society. And John Wilkins got together this club that met at 2 o'clock every Thursday, the experimental club. They were known as the Christian Virtuosi. And you'll recognize the names of them from the science you learnt at school. Here's one of them, Robert Boyle. I hope you learnt Boyle's Law. Robert Boyle's assistant was Robert Hooke. I hope you learnt Hooke's Law. Another chum at the experimental club was Halley. What date in English history do we know of because of Edmund Halley? Who knows the answer to that? Pardon? Yes, and what date does every school child, what's the first date that every school child learns? 1066. And we know that it was 1066 because in the Bayeux tapestry there is a comet, and it's Halley's comet. And he worked out what the period of his comet was, and that's how we date 1066. Another one became much, much better known as an architect, but at the time he was doing experiments on circulation of blood in dogs. And he did an experiment to investigate whether the dog's blood circulated in its brain. So he injected the dog with something that would have a neurological effect and timed how long it took. And had it been diffusion, I don't know, it would have taken half an hour or so. In fact, it happened within a minute or so, from which he deduced that the heart was pumping blood round the brain. His name was Sir Christopher Wren. And Robert Boyle, responsible for Boyle's Law, discovered the springiness of air, you know, the way that if you try and pump up a bicycle tire when the valve's not properly open, the pump just springs back at you. And he did it with a vacuum and a vacuum pump built by his colleague, Robert Hooke. And he wrote a treatise against someone called Linus, who was saying that if you have mercury in a barometer with a Torricelli vacuum, there's some sort of fibrillus something that's pulling the mercury up. And Robert Boyle was saying, no, the air is exerting a pressure. So here is his treatise on the spring and weight of air. And on the right-hand side is the table of data. It was a J-tube, if you remember the experiment, with some air here and then some mercury, and you measure the difference in the heights of the two bits of mercury and compare those with the length of the tube that's containing air. And there are columns of the measurements and the difference. And then the last column, column E, is what the difference should be, what the pressure should be, according to the hypothesis. The hypothesis is what we now call Boyle's Law. And there's no cheating. It's genuine data, okay? To the nearest 16th of an inch of height. But he's written it down honestly. And then he has a description of the experiment so that anybody else could perform it. And then he has a discussion of the experimental errors, what's now part of the apprenticeship of every research scientist. And it was Boyle who articulated it. Now, this same man, who blazed the trail for how we now do science, wrote a book called The Christian Virtuoso, showing that by being addicted to experimental philosophy, what we'd call experimental science, a man is rather assisted than indisposed to be a good Christian. You can see what fun we had collecting the illustrations for the book. In fact, it was quite hard because the Bodleian Library at Oxford would get out these beautiful first editions for us to choose illustrations from. And it was terribly hard to get on with the work because the books are so interesting, you wanted to stop and read them. Now, this metaphor that we've got of science swimming in the slipstream of ultimate questions, I really want to ask you a question now. I'd be interested in the discussion afterwards to know what you think. If you watch birds doing it, they take it in turns to be at the front because the one at the front has to work harder. So after a bit, they'll swap. Fish do the same when they're swimming in shoals. Tour de France cyclists do it when they're riding in a peloton. And it makes me wonder whether sometimes actually the order may change. Maybe we're at a time now where the hard work is being done by the experimental science. That's where the funding is. That's where the most person years are being put in. And maybe some of these big questions are now swimming in the slipstream of science, so that this whole order of the flock of birds maybe changes from time to time. And just to illustrate a case of that I've been involved in myself with Rolf Hoyer, the Director General of CERN, we had a series of three conferences in those 3 years that were intended to create a dialogue between scientists, philosophers, and theologians. Rolf Hoyer, the Director General of CERN, who, you know, that's the biggest experiment in the world by far, gave up 48 hours for each of these, you know, that he devoted to the discussion. No emails, no interruptions. This was just what he wanted to do and what he wanted to think about. In 2014, it was the 60th anniversary of CERN, the Hadron Collider in Geneva, and the leading French language newspaper in Switzerland, Le Temps, invited him to be the guest editor of its Saturday edition. And it carried an interview with him, and at his request it also carried an interview with me, where the interviewer asked me questions based on a presentation I'd given at that second conference. And you can't read it because it's too small, but there's the editor's comment, so there's Rolf Hoyer's comment in that little sort of box at the bottom of the right-hand page, and I'll blow it up for you so that you can read it. Instead of opposing science and religion, it would be better to ask if science and religion are capable of respecting and accepting each other's point of view. In my eyes, it's completely possible, and in my experience, it's even enriching. Well, now let's come back to Oxford. This is Henry Acland, the man who more than anyone else was responsible for the first purpose-built scientific building in Oxford, apart from the observatory, the Museum of Natural History. And he deliberately created it as a space where science and religion and art would come together. And the art you see from the fabulous sculptures of flora and fauna, which the artisans were explicitly encouraged to develop. There's James O'Shea, who was the sort of leading sculptor, working on one of the windows on the west side of the museum. And a lot of visitors who go in just look at the dinosaurs, but they should also look at these fabulous carvings where the craftsmen were given a free hand to be creative. In 2009, a debate was held in the museum between Richard Dawkins and John Lennox. Richard Dawkins is someone who's got a background in biology, but he's not really known for his research contributions to biology. He's more known for his militant atheism. And John Lennox is someone with a background in mathematics at Oxford, but again, he's not best known for his mathematical discoveries. He's best known for opposing Richard Dawkins, actually. And at one point in the debate, John Lennox turned to Richard Dawkins and asked if this building, where they were holding the debate, had not had a religious motivation. And Dawkins replied that it had not, and the discussion went on. They were both wrong. And had they looked up over their heads as they walked in through the entrance, they would have seen carved there this figure. It's got wings representing an angel, and in one hand there's a book, and in the other hand there's a dish of biological cells, the dish of cells representing science, and the book representing the Bible and religious curiosity. Now back to Cambridge and that man being visited by a priest as he was dying of cancer. You've probably recognized him. It's James Clerk Maxwell. Child prodigy. On the left-hand side of that slide is a paper that he wrote as a schoolboy on multifocal ellipses, or multifocal ovals, I think he called them. And I don't know, did you ever do the experiment when you were little, you know, you stick two drawing pins in and you have a loop of string and a pencil and you can draw an ellipse that way? And what he did was to extend that in a more complicated way so that the string was arranged with the one end of it tied to the pencil, and you get some interesting different shapes, which he analyzed mathematically. And the paper was read to the Royal Society of Edinburgh, not by him, because he was still a schoolboy, but by one of the fellows of the Royal Society of Edinburgh who was interested in it. Many years later, he wrote down those four equations on the right-hand side of that slide. He didn't use that notation. That's a modern notation for writing them. It's easier than the notation that he used. And those four equations, in my opinion, have been at least as influential as any theory of evolution. All the lighting we've got here, all the electromagnetic waves, all the broadcasting, the whole of the internet, this computer, everything we use that's an electrical or electronic technology makes use of Maxwell's equations and their implications. He was the first Cavendish laboratory at Cambridge. The earliest picture I could find of the interior of the Cavendish laboratory is this one. It's probably from the noughties of the 19th century. Of the 20th century, between sort of 1900 and 1910. The only character we can identify for sure in the picture is the rather dominant-looking man in the middle. That's George Searle. We grew up with Searle's apparatus for measuring heat flow. I don't know what you know of Searle's work. Isn't it rather remarkable that well over half a century before women were eligible to get a degree at Cambridge, the figure at the front of that laboratory is a woman? I find that striking. The entrance to the Cavendish Laboratory is this. And as a child, I would walk past the Cavendish Laboratory in Free School Lane and look at this inscription. It's quite hard to read because it's in a Gothic script, and anyway, it's in Latin, and not so many physicists read Latin nowadays. When I went to the Cavendish Laboratory as a graduate student, it had outgrown the old site in Free School Lane and moved to new buildings to the west of Cambridge. And there was a big blank space over the entrance to the new buildings. And I said to the then Cavendish professor, Sir Brian Pippard, that I thought it would be wonderful to have Maxwell's inscription on the new laboratory. I thought this space above the main entrance would be a wonderful place to put it. And now that not so many physicists read Latin, it would probably be better to have it in English. He agreed to put it to the departmental committee, and only years later did I learn that he was quite sure they would reject the idea. And he was absolutely astonished when they wholeheartedly approved it. And so it was put up, and I'll show you the next slide is actually the front piece of my PhD thesis, because by then the inscription was over the entrance. So that was me. A photograph taken while I was a PhD student. This is a photograph I took a couple of years ago in color with now glass doors at the entrance. And it's Psalm 111, verse 2. The works of the Lord are great, sought out of all them that have pleasure therein. And I love that as a motto for science, because it says that what scientists are doing is finding out how God makes the world work. And it's entirely consistent with James Clerk Maxwell's whole approach to his life and to his science. Happy is the man, he said, who can find in the work of today a portion of the work of life and an embodiment of the work of eternity. The inscription in English is slightly different from the inscription in Latin. If I was to give you a rough translation of the inscription in Latin, it would be, the works of the Lord are great, studied by everyone according to his pleasure. And you might ask, why is the Latin Vulgate different from this English translation? The Latin Vulgate follows the Septuagint, the Greek translation, that was made actually in Alexandria in Egypt, where we saw the school of philosophy where John Philoponus lived and worked. And the Septuagint, the best guess is that the Septuagint is probably an accurate translation of a variant Hebrew text. I think that's more likely than that it's a mistranslation. And so it's a rather lovely, this is the Coverdale translation, and most modern translations follow this, which follows the dominant sort of convergence of Hebrew texts. So you see there's a shift, isn't there? That the Septuagint was saying that God's works are great, and when we study them, we're doing it according to God's pleasure. God loves science, and he wants us to enjoy it. And here it's saying, perhaps closer to perhaps an original Hebrew, that actually we have great pleasure in doing it. And there's of course, you can have pleasure in doing science whether or not you believe in God. There's a real satisfaction in discovering something that wasn't previously known, or just discovering something you didn't previously know. There's a real pleasure in solving a bit of maths and getting the solution. And that's a genuine pleasure that anybody who engages in it can experience. But there's a sort of analogy with the friendship I have with Roger. The largest collection of early Wagner paintings is in our drawing room at home. And anybody can come into the drawing room and they can enjoy them. They're beautiful paintings, or others now are in other places. But for me, there's a sort of extra dimension of pleasure because I know Roger and because of our friendship. And so as well as enjoying the creation, I'm enjoying it as an expression of who the creator is. And I know something of what lies behind some of the paintings that he's done. And perhaps that's a sort of little tiny cameo metaphor for the way that the person who knows God gets an extra kind of a pleasure in learning about the material world, because they're learning about the creation of someone they know. So there we are, the penultimate curiosity, how science swims in the slipstream of ultimate questions.
Thank you so much, Andrew. That was fantastic. Now, if you caught a flavour of this, I can tell you the book is fantastic. And it's not just me. Amazon gets almost entirely 5 stars, which is quite a rarity. and to have it on sale at a reduced price is great. The other thing I like about the book, Andrew, is it's a lovely quality paper.
It is, isn't it? I agree with you. And that was one of the nice surprises that we didn't know until the first copy arrived.
So do think about getting that. The other thing I should say is that the next National Conference of Christians in Science, which will be next October the 21st, is called The Penultimate Curiosity, and it's going to be based around what Andrew's been talking about. We've got other talkers, and we've got Roger Wagner coming as well. So, and I believe I'm right in saying that if you join Christians in Science in your first year, we get the conference free. Is that right, Dan? Yeah, so added incentive to join. Anyway, time for a few questions from you. So do put your hand up if you've got a burning question.
was going to. I was just thinking about the question. Shall we read back? So the thesis really is that I think people like to think, some atheist scientists like to think of science and religion as obviously conflicting. And your thesis is that people were sort of thinking about God and they thought they would find out more about God by finding out more about the creation. But I think you did mention early on, didn't you, that there was there have been conflicts in the past in Greek thought. So Neptune being angry couldn't really be analysed scientifically. And I guess nowadays there are other conflicts with other readings of theology. Do you think there's a characteristic of certain religions that make them more or less amenable to a scientific mindset? For example, Islam, or is there something common to sort of religions that encourage science rather than discouraging?
I think that's a very interesting question, Tina. And I think one can sort of take a conceptual approach, one can take a historical approach. So the conceptual approach is this: what do you need in order for science to flourish? You need a confidence that there will be an order to be discovered. But you also need a humility that you probably aren't clever enough to work it out for yourself without doing some experiments. And either one of those is not enough by itself, I think. I think there's a further thing, actually, which is a sort of motivation of caring, a sense of responsibility. So, you know, Bacon cared about the welfare of humans. So he wanted, you know, people to study the natural world to the glory of God, but he also wanted people to study the natural world because it would help give them extra resources for making things better. I don't know, you know, I don't think he gave the example of clean drinking water, but clean drinking water and so on. And then you can look at it historically, and there have been cultures in which science flourished. You know, one of them was this extraordinary convergence of ideas in Miletus, the 6th century BC. So that was a Greek culture in which science flourished, in a culture in which they talked about and thought about the gods and whether the gods, you know, should activity should be described in terms of this sort of divine first cause. It flourished with John Philoponus. It flourished for a while in an Islamic culture, particularly in Spain, but also in Baghdad, but actually observatories built all over the Muslim world, but then fizzled out. It flourished in China for a while, but you have the great question asked by Joseph Needham as to why did science in China not continue to flourish? And then you have the, you know, the historical fact that science as we now know it, the great flourishing, you know, started about 300 years ago in Christendom. That you have to be very careful about giving a date because it had been developing for so long and with so many roots, you know, and some of them were slow burners. So I think it's a complex question, but the one thing you can't say is that it flourished in places where they didn't ask any other questions at all, except for scientific questions. That just is not true.
So I think it's a question.
Just your comment. Thank you very much for the very interesting talk. But the other night there was a program on Horizon about the Earth's magnetic field. And I thought that illustrated very well that quote from Psalm 111. And I know BBC aren't particularly noted for a Christian viewpoint, but the fact that magnetic field deflected the charged protons coming from the sun that would have harmed us, I thought, there's a God there behind it. And the design was there, and the uniqueness of the earth and so many properties that seem to be just right for life, I think gives me a real sense that God's in it. And thank you very much for emphasizing the sense of God in everything and just helping us to find out the works that he has in this universe. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this enticing vision. I have a very simple question which relates to your title and to your presentation. And the question is, if you speak about the penultimate curiosity, what is the ultimate curiosity?
That's for you to choose.
What do you say?
That's for you to choose.
Choose.
So what are you?
That's an evasion. That's an evasion.
No. What would you most like to find out?
I see.
What question would you most like to find an answer to within your lifetime?
Well, I look at it from a planetary, from a global point of view, what humanity is seeking. And I somehow feel that it is not enough to speak about the penultimate curiosity, because I feel we are driven as a species by an ultimate curiosity, not a pen. The penultimate are only steps, as I understand it. So where is the ultimate goal, or what is the totality or the inclusiveness and universality of the vision you are so beautifully describing in detail?
That's for you to choose, because if I could give you a 1-minute answer, it wouldn't take you a lifetime.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's not a simple question, but in your opinion, does it take a greater leap of faith to believe that the universe created itself and life is just one big accident, or does it take a greater leap of faith to believe in God?
I never understand this leap of faith concept, but I do understand probabilities. So people develop whole theories, you know, as to whether or not God probably exists or God probably doesn't exist. One of the best known is due to Richard Swinburne, who uses Bayesian probability theory to argue that there's a more than 50% probability that God does exist. It's probably a bit late in the evening for me to talk you through his whole argument, but I simply can't figure those out, because I don't know what the data points are. You know, we scientists, if we have a formula, we like to put numbers in, and we have no idea what numbers to put into Bayes' rule, you know, for that kind of argument. So I think it's better to think of it a different way and say this, that many, many people have noted how remarkable it is that things are just right for us to be here thinking about them. The ionosphere is one example. There are lots and lots of others. There are lots of quantities that, if they were slightly different, it's hard to know how we would be here and carbon-based life would exist. I don't think that or any other observation or argument is going to compel anyone to believe in God who doesn't want to. But I do think that this is the case, that for those who know God, who've chosen to know God for other reasons, when you see these remarkable phenomena, the fact that the universe exists, the fact that we have an ionosphere, you know, that the carbon resonance existed so that carbon could form out of primitive gases and so on, You get a wow factor from it. It's the sort of thing that would make Brian Cox say, "Isn't it amazing?" But for us, when we say, "Isn't it amazing?" there's a richness to it, because we're saying that in the context of knowing the Creator, who is amazing us with these things.
If I could follow up on that, do you think that as modern physics and cosmology begins to recognise more and more of the fine tuning. Some members of the scientific community are coming back to explore faith. As I get a sense, particularly in the physical sciences, there's a greater openness
yes.
to the existence.
Yes, I think that's right. Next week I'm going to be doing a conference in Arizona with Paul Davies. And Paul doesn't have a conventional Christian faith, but he is convinced that the universe has a purpose and that that purpose includes us.
Is he the one who says about Goldilocks?
Yes, he wrote a book called The Goldilocks Universe, yeah.
Another question at the back there.
Thank you for your talk, that was really stimulating. You seem to be a man of great intellectual curiosity, and I just wondered about, through your lifetime, you've obviously explored art, you've explored history, you've got your own specialist area. How do you work out what to concentrate on and what God was calling you to think deeply on?
Oh, I wish I knew the answer to that question. I fail miserably. I've got a butterfly mind, and I never stay long enough on one topic to make the sort of contribution I could if I was a bit more focused, I think.
Any other final questions? I should say that Andrew has, as he mentioned, flown in from the Bahamas overnight, so we're probably getting close. If I were you, I'd be getting close to the end of my energy levels, but if there are any other burning questions. Otherwise, I think we might ask if Tina's got a few things to say, if you, Tina. And then there'll be a few moments, no doubt, for personal questions and look at the books and so on. But Tina, I'll hand back to you.
Yes, thanks. Thanks very much for coming, Andrew. As Andrew mentioned, I do have a sort of romantic link to his household. But I think I just wanted to say a bit about Andrew's talk that he gave at the National Christians in Science Conference about this very question of probability. It was an incredible talk because I understood about the actual probability, but it was really just saying that as you get more and more information about this world, the probability of God gets bigger because it's so many things all coinciding, and having one bit of knowledge and then another bit has a sort of not just sort of adding on, but it's actually got a kind of multiplying effect. And it's just stayed with me that I just wanted to sort of give that tribute, really. And I'll just come at the front, sorry. I think what's really nice as well about this lecture is that so far, Christians in science, we have been very science, sort of, you know, somebody comes and talks about their bit of science and then sort of relates it. But I think this is the concept of looking at the art as well. And certainly we've been, recently, people have been talking about how arts lead you to God. And it's kind of, well, what about science then? And just the way of the art, it's about the science and the art's about God and sort of that kind of, the art is actually holding the science and the theology together in a really wonderful way. And I think I just also love the detective work that's gone into this, you know, looking at the detail and how that just opens up the sort of sense of wonder. I just haven't gone there in person, and I think there's something about the whole world that's just so beautiful, and that's kind of brought out in that film And I think, you know, it does, if you like, it's a sort of kindergarten, you know, people say it's a kind of wow, what a beautiful world, how could, you know, that points you to God. But that's actually giving a bit of substance to that sort of intuitive understanding that children have. And it's actually sort of, not exactly counting it, but just, I think the way art does it is to sort of holistically bring it to you in a sort of, bringing together the art, the science. So I think it's absolutely beautiful, and I'm really hoping that we'll be able to do more of this. We're actually bringing in all aspects of our human experience and the hints and the evidence they give of God. And I'm just thank you so much for that. It's really very special, and It's just a very special night tonight, as you say, for lots of different reasons. So thank you again for coming from Bahamas. The final thing to say, Andrew's booked at the back, £20 from 25. And I'm very sorry it's a bit cold here tonight. My husband actually was church warden of the church that Andrew and Diane, we all went to up in Oxford, and his most important thing was to get the heating right, and I'm very sorry, we can't do anything about it. So we are going to try again to have a discussion after this. So the Steam Pub, if you go straight across White Ladies Road, you'll see Cliftonland Station. Go down into the station, it was the Rue Bar, and that's called the Steam Pub. It's got a lovely area where you can just sit and talk about these things and hopefully just get to know each other as well. And I'm hoping this talk's going to do something in the way of bringing us together as a community, a network here in Bristol. So please try and hang around. I'll need a little bit of help with perhaps one or two volunteers washing up. Anyone? Thank you. And I think that's it. So thank you very much for coming, everyone. You should have a term card on your chair. So the next talk is Tong McLeish in March. It's at Alma Church. So don't come back here. Go to Alma Church. Thank you very much.